Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. If you watch much NBA basketball in the 80s, you probably got used to hearing something like this.
Collins to Bobby Jones, going to the hoop. Basket counts and a foul on Bird.
Bobby Jones built a career on his ability to guard other players, to the point where Nike created a marketing campaign calling him the Secretary of Defense. He was an All-Star five times in his 12-year pro career, and won an NBA title in 1983 as part of a great Philadelphia 76ers team that included Moses Malone and Dr. J, Julius Erving. Before that, Jones played for Dean Smith at North Carolina and also played for Team USA in the 1972 Olympics, which put him in the middle of one of the most controversial games in sports history. After retiring from the NBA, Bobby moved back to his hometown of Charlotte and coached high school basketball for years. We taped this interview last week after Game 2 of the NBA Finals between Golden State and Cleveland. I had hoped, and Bobby had assumed, that the two teams would still be playing. But Golden State had other plans. They swept Cleveland in four games for the title. Still, Bobby Jones has a lot to say about today's NBA and what it was like when he played, and a lot of other things. Here's our conversation. Okay, Bobby Jones. I think a lot of us suffer from what we call recency bias, where the thing we see at the moment might think is the best we've ever seen. So first of all, Golden State as a team. Have you seen better teams than that over the years? Do you think that other teams, could your Sixers teams could have played with them pretty easily?
I don't know the answer to that. When you look across the board, somebody's going to be open. Somebody's going to have somebody not quite as good a defender on them. And, there's just not that many teams that I can recall that could handle that type of team.
Do you ever, as somebody who was known for his defense in the league, do you ever watch one of those games and look at, say, Kevin Durant and say, how would I check that guy?
I do, and that would be tough. I mean, just the length of my – he reminds me of Kevin McHale a little bit. But Kevin was more of a low-post player, and he had a nice touch. But, Durant has that range that, my history of playing basketball has been – I've rarely seen a player who – you really can't affect their shot by getting a hand close to where the ball is. Even if you don't touch the ball, it makes, if you go past their head and their eyes, it makes them wonder. And I don't know if Durant's one of those guys or not. I haven't seen anybody, block his shot. So
he's so tall. By the time he jumps, it's hard to get even a hand up there.
It is. I would just I think the first time I ever played him, I would probably just slap his arm and just take a foul.
You were traded for George McGinnis at one point, right? And that was when you moved from Denver to the Sixers, and that was when the Sixers really kind of took it up a level, I guess. And, I mean, you were certainly part of that.
Yeah, that was a real blessing for me. I was going through some physical problems at the time. I had diagnosed with epilepsy, and I was, in fact, in Denver, I was taking actually two different medications. I had a heart arrhythmia or a heart fibrillation problem. So I was taking a medication for that. And then when this epilepsy came along, or the seizure disorder, they call it now, the combination of those two medications really caused me to become kind of a space cadet, just kind of zoned out and kind of in a funk at the end of that last year with Denver. And so I don't blame them for trading me, but it was really one of the – career-wise, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, just to get to another city, low altitude, a general manager who, was a good friend, good guy, and a good team, and closer to home. So it really worked out well.
And once you got there, did your medications change, or did something happen that – you'd been dealing with that for a long time?
Right? I had, yeah. The medication changed. Well, when I left Denver, the altitude – I guess I can blame it on the altitude. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but the heart problem went away. I would start, like in Denver, when I first, as a rookie, I would come off, I would start the game, and after 5 minutes, my arms would be weak and my legs would be weak, and they said my heart was fibrillating. And so they gave me medication to prevent that. And then when I got to Philly, that disappeared. So I was just on the phenobarbital from that point for the seizure disorder. And so I could function well. And it's funny how things work out. I mean, I remember my doctor, when he gave me the phenobarbital, said, "Now, you know, it's not a performance enhancing drug. It's a performance de-enhancing drug. It's a depressant. It's going to slow your reactions down. It's going to slow." So you're not going to be the player you're going to be. You used to be. And I said, "Well, you know, as a Christian, you know, as the Lord leads, if that's the case, and I've got to live."
So right.
Took it, and it's funny. I was able to go back to him a couple of years later and said, "Well, you know, Doc, I made the All-Star team 2 more times, and you know, I was led forwards and steals and stuff. So, you know, it didn't affect me too badly. So I'm thankful for that."
And didn't you have asthma or something too?
I did have. Well, I developed asthma after I retired.
Oh, okay. Yeah, after your time.
Strange thing.
Yeah. So it's not exactly the medical profile of a pro athlete, right?
No, not really.
You had to obviously play through a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, everybody has something. I look at my career as an athlete. I was very fortunate. I was on teams where I didn't have to share the load as far as scoring or rebounding. And, you know, because of my physique, I was thin and I would bruise, but I wouldn't break. And that was, I looked at a lot of my opponents, they'd be out 6 weeks with a stress fracture or something, a strain of something. And I was on injured reserve one time in my career, and that was for a broken big toe. Yeah. And my teammate kicked me. I was fortunate in that area that I did have not many injuries.
I want to circle back to the finals, and that's because you played in three finals, right?
Yeah. Well, actually four in the ABA.
In the ABA, I'm sorry. Yeah. So, and you've been in a similar situation, maybe down 0-2 or 3-1 or something like that. What is that like in the locker room at practice? What does it feel like, and what are y'all talking about?
Well, you don't talk about much. We didn't. I remember we played we were playing in the conference semifinals against Milwaukee, and we beat them on a Saturday. And we had to fly to Boston that afternoon and play Boston the next day in Boston.
They don't do that anymore, do they?
They don't do that anymore, yeah. No. And we lost by 40, and I didn't score a point. And I was just exhausted. I mean, I think everybody was exhausted. And we were kind of resentful of that scheduling. And I think that led us to end up winning that series because we, you know, I think most of these teams, and I think Cleveland has it too, they have a mental toughness to overlook and push behind whatever failures have happened in the past and just say, here's what we've got to do now, and let's do it. So, again, I go back to a situation. Again, we were playing Boston in another series, and we were up. We were 3-1 against them, I think it was. And they came back and tied it, and we were going back to Boston for game 7. And, you know, everybody wrote us off and said, you know, you're not going to win this game. And I remember we had I had a teammate named Mike Banham, and Mike is now an executive in the NBA. And one of our team meetings, it's just players only, he said, listen, he said, you know, the thing that bothers me the most about this whole deal is not that people don't respect our game or us, it's that I think the Celtics don't respect us. You know, our physicality is not high enough, and it's not, you know, we haven't engaged the enemy strongly enough. And so we decided that last game, you know, just to say, hey, whatever it takes, we're going to do what we have to do. And so I remember one of the very first plays of the game, they shoot the ball and we're on defense. And I instead of boxing out Kevin McHale, I just drove him into the front row seats. We both fell into the seats, and the referee's right there and just looks at us. No call. And so that's just the way it is, you know, and that's the way it is these days. I mean, they guys are going down the lane and getting clocked, and, you know, they look around at the official looking for a call, and then he's not going to give them a call. And that's just life in the NBA. The playoffs are totally different.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think people who maybe are not big sports fans or big NBA fans, from the outside, the NBA playoffs just seems really ruthless in terms of there are so many rounds you have to go through, and then each round, now seven games in each round, yeah, where you're playing the same guys you played the last four or five games, and you're sick of each other and all that sort of thing. That's my impression from the outside. What's it feel like on the inside?
No, that's an accurate description. I relate it back to the old ABA days when we only had 10 teams and you played everybody. You know, instead of four times, you played them 8 or 10 times. And that got really old fast. That caused a lot of fights and a lot of, you know, disgruntled attitudes among players. But yeah, that's just the way it is. It's just, you've scouted, you know, the scouting system now is so great and everything's so detailed of what a guy can do that, yeah, you have to figure out what else can you do to arise above the level that you were at before. And that's a challenge.
So I wanted to ask about you taking McHale in the front row there. You know, obviously you're a man of faith and somebody who wants to play fair. I remember I read something about you where Paul Salas had sort of taught you a move that may or may not have been legal. And you said, I'm not going to do that. It's not me. So where's the line for you, or where was the line for you, and what you felt like you could do?
Well, again, you know, in the NBA, it's like, I don't know if it's like life or not, but I was always willing to hold somebody and take a foul. I'll pay there's consequences in life. You know, as a Christian, there's, you know, for sin, there's consequences. in life, there's if you speed, you're going to get a ticket. So, you know, in basketball, it's the same thing. If I held a guy and if I knew I was beat and I hold a guy, I'm willing to take the free throws or the out of bounds and a foul on myself. I don't feel like I'm doing anything wrong, you know, morally wrong. But basketball is a very aggressive, cutthroat game, and I recognized early on when I first got into the league, I was with the Nuggets, and I was one of two Christian guys on the team, and my roommate was an older guy and nice guy and really smart guy, and I noticed quickly that he would always be ridiculed for his faith because he wasn't aggressive, or he wasn't as aggressive as they thought he should be. And I noticed quickly that because I could block their shot or I could steal the ball from them, they didn't give me any grief.
Right.
And so I learned quickly that, you know, if I'm going to have success in this league, I wasn't a scorer. You know, I wasn't a great rebounder. I was a decent rebounder. But, you know, my strength was, you know, defense, taking a charge, you know, stripping a ball from a guy, you know, those kind of things. And to do those things, you have to be aggressive and that's what I had to do.
And I know that plays into a stereotype that I think is a inaccurate stereotype, that to be, you know, a Christian ball player or anything else for that matter, that you have to be meek or something. And that, you know, I think obviously there's aggressive. What I was trying to get at was that line. Like, where did you feel like you had to draw the line?
Yeah.
Or you know, what you felt like you couldn't do.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you know, like on the breakaway, if a guy's going in for a layup, one of my favorite plays was try to come from behind and block it from behind. But you know, if I couldn't, I'm not going to ever shut the guy. I'm not going to, you know, there's just certain things that I'm just not going to do. I'll give another example of it. I was playing in a game my last year in the league, and this is in San Antonio, and the ball goes out of bounds, and the ref, you know, I blocked his view. And so he asked me, as he goes to get the ball, he asked me, did you touch it? And so I'm shocked that he's asking me to make the call. You know, I get to play and make the call. And I said, no, I didn't touch it. And I hadn't. And so he said, okay, red ball. So we got the possession. Well, 2 weeks later, now again, I played 12 years. So this is the second time in 12 years it's ever happened. Same official back in Philly now. We're playing the Nets. The ball goes out of bounds again. I block the same official's view right in front of our bench. Our coach, Billy Cunningham, catches the ball. And at this time, it had ticked off my fingertips. And the ref comes up to me in front of my coach, says, hey, Bobby, did you touch it? And I said, yeah, I did. And I just started walking away because I knew Billy was going to explode. And he did. Billy goes, starts tapping his feet and stomping. He says, Bobby, that's his job. Let him make the call. You know, I thought to myself, you know, that's this guy trusted me with some integrity, and I'm not going to lie about for a possession. I'm not going to break that trust. So, you know, yeah, there's, you know, as a Christian, there's certain things you got to say, hey, this is right, this is wrong.
That's a great story. Yeah. I I'm curious about what you said a little earlier about you feeling like the aggression now is, you know, just as great or that sort of thing, because my impression is that the league was much more physical when you were playing. You know, there's these classic, you know, Kevin McHale taking down Kurt Rambis and sort of breakaways where people would get put in the stanchion and all that sort of thing. Are the players, do you feel like they really are as physical? Or is the game being called differently maybe?
I think it was more physical when I was playing. There was much more holding, a lot more dirty plays. These days, there's so many cameras out there. There's so many officials that you're not going to get away with a whole lot. You're going to pay the consequences.
If you don't get caught during the game, you'll get caught.
That's right. Yeah, you're going to pay the piper one way or the other. And but again, emotions do take over, and things do happen. But I look at these athletes today. I mean, they're so much greater as far as athleticism than the players that we played against or myself. That it's just a big difference. So. I would say that, you know, one thing that I noticed differently is that most players don't – like Maurice Cheeks was one of my teammates, and he would always turn his man as he brought the ball up the court two or three times every time. And nobody does that. Nobody works hard on defense full court. They may work hard, you know, to deny the ball a couple of times or something. But, you know, and I look at Steph Curry. I look at him and think that here's a guy that – you know, he's a little guy, you know, how does he get his shot off? Well, he gets his shot off because he comes over two or three or four screens. And, you know, they may cover him for the first couple of screens, but after three or four screens, he's going to get open. And because of him and his teammates have decided that's what they need to do. And the other team just can't or won't physically be able to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned Steph. So I know that back early on in his life, or is you coached him briefly, right?
Briefly, yeah. I was assistant coach at Charlotte Christian. I had retired from being the head coach, and Sean Brown was the head coach. And one summer, I was asked, Steph's dad, we were to coach an AAU team with Steph, and Dell couldn't make the first tournament, and I could make the first tournament, but I had basketball camp later. So I took the team up to Maryland for a tournament, and I enjoyed that. You know, just he was the smallest guy out there. And I remember after one of our games, I think we won maybe three, lost two. I'm not sure. But I remember telling the players, now look around this room. You know, look who got most of the rebounds. You know, this little guy right here. And he was always a good rebounder, Steph was. And, you know, you could just tell that he was a kid who had the light bulbs on in his brain, basketball-wise. He knows where to go, what to do, and what situation is going to happen. And so that makes a big, big difference for him.
He was famously, as you know, sort of undervalued coming out of high school and even coming out of college to some extent. And I don't think anybody could see the player that he could become, probably maybe the greatest shooter in NBA history. Yeah. Did you see things back then that made you think, let me just add sort of a fundamental way. Did you see a future NBA player when you're watching him when he's 15 or whatever?
No, I did not see a future NBA player. I did see a player who was, to me, it was amazing to watch him play. I enjoyed watching him play because whether it was practice or whether it was a game, like I said earlier, he always found a way. Like, you know, most point guards, and he was a point guard back at the time, would come down, distribute the ball, and just stay in that area. Well, he would always be under the basket. He would always either be getting a rebound, and looking to strip the ball from somebody, and just he had a different mindset about what he needed to do and what he could do. And, you know, again, he was undersized and got pushed around a lot. And I remember their state championship game, went to the finals of that and watched it. And, you know, he didn't have a great game. There was some physicality there that it was tough for him to handle because they keyed on him and he was the main guy, of course. But, you know, you could always tell this guy is a competitor, and it's been fun to watch him compete.
Yeah. So now how about you? When you were a kid, was basketball something that was sort of front of mind for you or what?
Oh, no. I I didn't like basketball. I didn't like sports. I was a kid that liked to come home from school and watch TV. And I have a brother Kirby, who was a good athlete. He was 2 years ahead of me. He played basketball at Oklahoma University, and my dad had played up basketball at Oklahoma University and had been invited to try out for the New York Knicks and declined that and went to work for Goodyear and played for the Goodyear AAU team back in the 50s, I guess. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to play basketball. I didn't want to play sports at all. And my dad made me. He finally said, listen, you know, you're going to be big, and I want you to try out for a team. So when we moved to Charlotte, I was going into the sixth grade. And so I played in a church league. And, you know, I didn't enjoy it. But my dad, he gave me some things to do. He traveled for Goodyear Tire. He's on the road a lot during the week. So he gave me a list of things I had to do every afternoon after school. So I'd come home and had to do like 15 tips on one side, 15 on the other, layups, free throws, different shots. And, you know, not a whole lot. But, you know, I didn't really, again, didn't want to do it. But so I figured out a way to get around it. So I would come home and get my soda, which, you know, was terrible for me. Always caused a lot of my problems. But go down to the basement, and outside of our basement door, we had a dirt court with a wooden, you know, basketball goal up there and fiberboard backboard. And so I would watch my show. But then at the end of the show, I would take a break and run out there for 2 minutes between shows. I'd go dip real quick. And then I'd come back in and watch another show. And then at the break of that, I'd come out and do some more. And then there'd maybe be a 5-minute segment for the news, and I'd get a little bit more done. And I got to do both. And I noticed that later on, like on Saturday, when I didn't watch TV, I'd go out there and do it all at one time. And it took me so much longer to do it one time because I'd get distracted, or the ball rode down the hill. I wasn't focused. But I was focused during those 2 or 3 minutes. And I really learned a lot about how to, you know, really make yourself concentrate on one thing and do it as well as you can in those 2 or 3 minutes that you had before you had to go to do something else. So
as probably at least some people who are going to be listening to this know, you ended up playing at North Carolina, mm-hmm, under Dean Smith. How did that come about, by the way? Did you have other offers? Were you looking at other places, or?
Tommy, I wasn't highly recruited. I was recruited in the southeast part of the country. You know, Duke, Florida, those were really the only other two schools. Oklahoma, where my brother was attending at the time. I remember the story, John McLeod, who was the great NBA coach after that, who was coaching my brother at Oklahoma, came and visited me and said, he said, listen, you know, you can be one of 100 All-Americans at North Carolina, or you can be one of few All-Americans at Oklahoma. And I thought, you know, I think I can be better than one of hundreds. So, you know, I didn't want to leave home. So, you know, I did end up going to North Carolina. I liked the coaches. I felt like the coaches were really real people. John Lotz, Bill Guthridge, and Coach Smith, all three of them were to me, sincere people. And I appreciate that. I like the coach at Florida. Tommy Bartlett was a coach at Florida. I really liked him. But the dorms were inside the football stadium. And so, it was, you know, it was just a football school. And, you know, I'd grown up watching Duke and North Carolina. And it was an easy choice for me.
You played, I didn't know this until I was looking you up. I thought I knew a lot about your career. You played in the infamous 72 Olympics.
Yes.
You were on the U.S. Olympic team. Just for people who don't know, the U.S. to that point had never done anything but win the gold medal. Mm-hmm. In the finals, there was this classic game against the Russians where basically the U.S. won the game and the Russians got to play the ending three times until they made a basket and won. And I guess I'd just like to hear what that felt like from somebody who was there that day.
Well, the ending was not what I'd wished for. You know, it was kind of a surreal environment. It was the game started at 11:30 at night. So they'd be televised back to the United States at prime time, or at a decent hour, I guess. And it was just the crowd was so great that they said there was a king, some king of some country couldn't get a seat. So they let him sit on the baseline, you know, just, So, but, you know, it was a good game. It was just different. We had the youngest team ever, probably, I think, playing against some Army veterans from Russia, and they were good players. They had one guy who was an NBA player, no doubt, Alexander Belov. And
is Belov the guy who made the basket at the end?
He is the guy that made the basket. Yeah. He was a great athlete, and the way that game ended, I was on the bench. I had started every game in the Olympics for some reason. I'd never started in college, and I made the Olympic team, and I started every game. I played the first 5 minutes, and then I would come back in every once in a while, but not very often. And I don't know if they wanted to set a tone defensively. Coach Iva liked defense, and that's what all I could do. So I was sitting on the bench, and one of our best players, Jim Brewer, had had a concussion, and he didn't know who he was or where he was. So I was sitting on the bench trying to tell him what's going on and trying to watch the end of the game at the same time. So it was really a mix of a lot of emotions, a lot of things going on that it was hard to deal with at the time.
So, and basically you guys celebrated twice, right?
We did. We celebrated. In fact, we actually made it into the locker room, and they said, you need to come out or you're going to have to forfeit the game and all this. And, so we came back out, and it was chaos. I look back on it, and I see a lot of the guy that orchestrated most of that was a guy named Robert Jones, no relation to me. He's from England, and I think he's head of FIBA, maybe, I'm not sure, but
which is the international sort of basketball.
Yes, and I think his desire was he wanted basketball to grow worldwide, and he felt like the only way that it would ever do that would be for somebody else to win an Olympic gold medal besides the United States. And, that's probably true. That probably did help. But to do it, illegally or, deceptively is I wouldn't agree with. But
And do you feel like that's what happened, that it was?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. After we won the game, after the first horn sounded, I don't know if he came down at that time, but the Russians said they'd tried to call a timeout on that second inbounds. And so they were awarded an extra timeout or whatever, and given the ball again. And then as the clock ended after the second time, with 3 seconds left on the clock, we thought we won again. And that's when he came out of the stands, and he didn't have the power to do this, but he told the officials and the scorekeeper, he said that was a quick 3 seconds. They didn't have the tenths of a seconds back then.
Right.
So he said that wasn't a full 3 seconds. Although it showed 3 on the clock, he said you need to go back and run it from 10. And as soon as it hits 3, stop it quickly. So they'll have a full 3 seconds. And that's when they threw the three-quarter length pass, and our two defenders hit each other trying to block it. And Belov caught it and laid it in for the winning basket. So, I look back on it and I think, well, we actually won the Olympic gold medal twice and they won it once. So, and I don't feel bad about that. In fact, we had a reunion 5 or 6 years ago, and there was a gentleman from Chicago who found out where who had made those gold medals, and he had 12 more struck and gave each one of us a gold medal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was really.
Well, I know the famous story is that the team has refused to accept the silver medals.
Yeah.
And I, if I remember this right, at that reunion a few years ago, you guys kind of had another vote on that and you refused again. Is that correct?
Yeah. We're not. Yeah. There was no desire to. In fact, after the game, when we, they said, well, you've got to go out to accept the silver medal. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. And again, they threatened us. They said, well, you're going to put in jeopardy the United States' chance to come back and play the next Olympics. And, we voted. And it wasn't unanimous at the time. It was one guy that didn't want to he wanted to compromise. Tom McMillan, who's a political guy.
Sure.
And I think he had a few threats in the locker room. So after it was all over, it was unanimous. And I don't think anybody has changed their mind since.
And you have no interest in that?
No, I don't have any. I really do feel like we won a gold medal, and I'm not bitter about it. In fact, even if it had turned out the same way, I would do it over again. Just the experience of playing for my country. I wasn't even invited to the tryouts. Coach Smith had got me in because Bill Walton was protesting the war, and Marvin Barnes was under arrest for a tire iron thing.
a tire iron thing.
Yeah, he had attacked somebody with a tire iron. And so, yeah, I was just happy to be there, and it was a real blessing to be a part of that.
Now, have you ever met any of those Russian players?
Yes.
Since then?
I have. In fact, a year later, they scheduled a 7-game series in the United States where they came over, and we started on the West Coast, and we played a series of games. It wasn't the Olympic team, but it was myself, and I can't remember most of the other players, but I know Bill Walton played the first couple of games, and what a difference he made.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did stay in the same hotel with those guys, and what I learned, a couple of things I learned, is that, one, they were afraid to drink our water. They brought suitcases of vodka, and that's what they drank.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not a performance-enhancing substance.
Not really.
Either.
Not at all. No. And they wanted jeans. They wanted blue jeans is the main thing they wanted. But, you know, as I looked at them, I got to know, you know, their background. They were Army. They were workers. They were just – and I have to say, looking back at it, that – the winning the gold for them made more of a difference in their life than it would have made in the lives of the players on our team. So, you know,
yeah, I'm sure they're heroes forever.
Yeah, made their careers, and yeah, you know, and that wouldn't have changed much for the players that were on our team.
Did any of those guys ever say, "Okay, you guys won the game"?
No, the language barrier was so great. We never got to that deep a conversation. No.
When we come back, Bobby Jones talks about his role in one of the most famous comebacks in college basketball history. Duke fans, close your ears. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
In June 2015, a woman named Linda was sexually assaulted by a stranger in Charlotte, and she has a lot of questions about her investigation.
I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't at this point.
WFAE's new investigative podcast, She Says, is available now. Listen to the first episode on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and on WFAE.org/She Says.
Support for She Says is provided by Contemplative Rebellion.
So at North Carolina, a couple of years later, you were involved in a game that is not, I guess, internationally as famous, but certainly in America is really well known, the UNC-Duke game in 74, The famous, for people who don't know, you're down 8 points to Duke with 17 seconds left, and you ended up tying the game and winning in overtime. And I went back and looked at the tape. You scored 4 of those 8 points. Mm-hmm. So what was that? I guess what I'd like to know is, what was that like in the huddle as you guys were putting that together?
Well, this was a great lesson for me as a future coach. Coach Smith was just so positive and so calm. I think I made the two free throws or whatever and called a timeout and we came over and he was just smiling. He was just happy and wasn't mad about anything and just said, hey, here's how we're going to do this. Okay. We're going to put this press on and we're going to try, but you're going to shoot the gap here. We're going to try to get to steal. And then, you know, then the next time out, okay, after they miss this free throw, we're going to do this and this and this. And, you know, it worked out exactly as he had said. And even if it hadn't, you know, he had trained us to be compliant in the way we play our game, to be obedient to what his instructions were. And I think that was a critical part of our game, of how we won. We were compliant. We did try to perform at our best, and we weren't discouraged. And we had a great coach. So, and Duke missed some shots. So, yeah.
Did you believe during that time?
I did. No, I did. I actually did. His confidence, you know, was infectious. And I think all of us, like, this is a great opportunity. This is not something scary. This is a great opportunity that we have to win this game. And so, yeah, it was, you know, I don't know that we even thought about winning the game. I think we thought about the next possession or the next situation.
Right.
And then at that point, once it got down to where they were shooting free throws and, you know, if they miss, we could, out, you know, have a chance to hit the winning shot. that's when we thought about, yeah, we got a shot at winning it.
So as you know, Dean Smith is maybe the most admired coach in any sport ever. Certainly one of the, in the top few. As somebody who played for him, what was it about him that inspired you, or what things do you remember most about him?
Well, he was a very real person. He was a person who didn't assume things about people. And I'll give you some examples. One, I remember as a freshman, I came in there and I came into his locker, into his office, and he said to me, and it's just a one-on-one meeting, he said, "Bobby, are you the kind of guy that needs to be yelled at to be motivated?" And I was just stunned that he would ask me that. You know, I've had coaches who yelled at me, you know, and yell and scream, and a lot of coaches back, you know, then did that. That's what people did, and probably still now do it. But, you know, I answered him honestly. I said, "Well, you know, Coach, I don't like to be yelled at. If you can tell me what I'm doing wrong, then I'll try to correct it." And, you know, he never, for 4 years, he never raised his voice at me, never yelled at me. And I had a teammate, Ed Stahl, who said to him, he said, "You know, I need a kick in the rear end every once in a while." And so he would yell at Ed, but not, you know, so he would figure out what motivated people, what people needed. And he knew people. Like he allowed us to go home one weekend during the season, and we had to be back Friday, Sunday night for practice. And so I'm coming back from Charlotte and it's snowing. So I've got to drive slow, and it's dangerous out there. And so I get there and the team is already on the court. And so I'm running through the thing to get my practice stuff, and I hustle out there and I'm just waiting for, you know, get on the steps and start running. And it didn't say a thing. You know, he understood. He knew the situation and he knew I wasn't trying to con him or anything. So I always appreciated about him.
Yeah. Well, I know that, I think you and I maybe first met when, toward the end of Dean's life, or in the last few years, when the thing I remember is there was an alumni game there that was at Smith Center that was designed to be sort of a tribute to Coach Smith, and he was brought out there. And I think at that point he knew what was going on, and partially he was, for those who don't know, he struggled with dementia the last few years of his life. And I remember talking to you about you approaching him after that and just trying to figure out, first of all, if he would know who you were and then what you would want to say.
Well, we had been told just to say, if you approach him, just tell him who you are. Just don't make him work to have to figure out who you are. And that's true for me now. I mean, I look at some of my former teammates and think, some of my former players. And so, but no, it was just, that was a special time and I think just the turnout of the people that were there showed the level of admiration and appreciation that we all have for what he did for our lives.
And did he keep in touch after your playing days and all that?
Yes.
I've always heard about little letters or notes or phone calls and that sort of thing.
Oh, gosh, yeah, so many times. He helped me with the epilepsy. He helped me find a doctor to treat it. When I signed my first contract, he had helped me find an agent. And when the agent sent me the bill for the contract, I sent it on to Coach Smith for him to look at, and he was upset with it. He said, "They're charging you too much." And so he said, "I'll take care of this." And so he sent a letter to the guys, and he said, "Listen, if you want any more of our players, you're going to deal with this bill." And so he cut it way down.
Oh, great.
So, you know, he was really like a second father, just looked after his players and took care of them. And, you know, if you needed a job or if you needed something, you know, you could go to Coach Smith and he would do what he could to help you.
Yeah. I guess I should go. You know, you talked at the beginning about not liking basketball very much when you started out. What, if at any point, I guess I don't want to assume, at what point did you start to like and love playing basketball?
that's a good, tough question. I did enjoy it in high school, and I liked it in college also. The pros, it's work. I mean, it's a grind. It's 100 games a year, and it's night work. It's manual labor, mostly night work, you know, and so – and
you're on the graveyard shift, guy.
Yeah, graveyard shift, and I'm getting beat up every night. So, I mean, I enjoyed the winning. There's a lot that I enjoyed, but there's a lot that I didn't enjoy. The travel, you know, the especially with the epilepsy, you know, the odd hours and all that. I honestly don't know how players can do it that are on losing teams, because I was on a winning team every year, and we made the playoffs every year. And I mentally, I don't know. I look back on my life, and I was a high jumper in high school and middle school, and actually went to the national AAU tournament finals in San Diego for that. And I think I really enjoyed that more than basketball. But, you know, as far as a career goes, basketball was very great for me and very helpful. And it was the step that I think the Lord had me to go into, whether I enjoyed it a lot. I did enjoy it, but there were, you know, it's bittersweet. There's a lot of things I didn't enjoy about it.
Yeah. I want to ask something. I don't know how to ask this indelicately, so I'm just going to try to figure out. I'm going to stumble my way through it.
Sure.
So, as you said, you were a high jump champion. And if anybody looks up YouTube highlights of you, you know, you are jumping out of the gym. You're very fast. You're very quick. There's a great little YouTube clip of you dunking over Larry Bird in a game and all that sort of thing. And as I was looking up stories and things that people had said about you, there's a quote from Julius Erving, one of your teammates, talking about all that and then saying, you know, basically, he kind of has the skills of a black player. And I know that these are stereotypes that are difficult to talk about or think about and all. But I remember when I was growing up watching you, that I remembered you seemed to be faster, jump higher, quicker than the other white players who were on the court at the time. And I guess what I'm wondering, without, you know, getting too much into this, is that something that teammates talked about with you, opposing players, coaches? Was that just something that you were conscious of or was discussed when you were playing?
No, that would be mentioned every once in a while. In fact, I remember a couple of situations. One, Sport Magazine had me on their cover, and the thing that one of the articles was five players who are white who play like they're black and five black players who play like they're white. And there's a stereotype of how people play. And, you know, that's just the way it is. That's just life. And we all have different prejudices and stereotypes and things that we think that should be some way. And, you know, I think I probably was a little different in that stereotype. I remember one time we were playing, we had the training camp, and before training camp, you had to go in and get a physical. So there were a lot of us in the room, and there was a couple of rookies in the room. And this one rookie was a young black guy and good player. And, he came in, and I had just finished my summer, and in the summer I didn't do a whole lot. I came in, I was pale, and you know, I'm always thin. I'm not defined or anything. So he looked at me and didn't say anything. But then we started playing, you know, the next week, and he came up to me about 2 weeks later. And he said, man, I just got to tell you. He said, when I walked in that doctor's office and saw you, he said, I thought, man, you ain't. And then the profanity came out of his mouth. And he said, but when I started playing against you, he said, man, I was wrong. So that was a real compliment that he gave me. And I appreciated that a lot.
I've always been interested in how teams work, because it's a fairly small group of people who are all kind of put together with a common purpose and coming from very different backgrounds, social lives, you know, histories, that sort of thing. What did you find over the years made for a good team or a team that didn't do as well, besides obviously talent?
Well, I think the desire to win. I think that is the most important thing that takes place. And again, I go back to our 83 championship team. We still stay in touch. Andrew Toney, who was one of our shooting guards, he keeps a website, not a website, but an email line open to everybody and sends out like news every week or every 2 weeks about what's going on with somebody's life. And we had a reunion with Billy Cunningham and everybody else. The owner flew us all out to Las Vegas about 4 or 5 years ago for an anniversary. And so there is a closeness that is, you know, there is some adversity. And so it's not like war exactly. You know, nobody's going to get killed, but there is a closeness that is engendered by the pressure of the situation that you're under at the time. And that does, you know, overcome, you know, whatever backgrounds we may all have or our thoughts that we may have about other parts of life, that really endears them and me to them and them to me.
I think another thing about the NBA, especially even as compared to other sports, is that they're, you know, teams kind of go on runs where they're really good for several years and they end up playing each other again and again in the playoffs. So the Sixers lost to the Lakers twice in the finals in 80 and 82, if I remember right, and then finally beat them, swept them in 83. What was that like to sort of get over that hump and to have that moment
finally? Well, it was a great moment. It was a lot of fun. The first time we lost to them, Magic went crazy, and Jamal Wilkes also had a great game.
Magic famously had that where he started at center and scored 42 points.
Yes, that's right. And Jamal had 37, I think. I mean, so they played well. They deserved it. And the second time they beat us, they deserved it again. They were just a better team. And that's these days, I don't hear too many people saying, hey, they were just better tonight.
Right.
It's always somebody else's fault. But in 83, with the addition of Moses, it was still the hardest thing I've ever done physically. I mean, I was just, after that series, I was just worn out. I mean, the intensity, every one of those Laker games that we end up winning, we were losing at halftime of every one of them. And so it wasn't like, we just coasted through it. We had to come back and play defense and just shut them down or try to get some points. And so it was, to me, athletically, it was a great accomplishment. And I certainly appreciate it.
Mm. So one more question about your career real quick. There may be more, but the last couple of years of your career, Charles Barkley arrived on the Sixers, and we were just talking about different body types in the NBA. Yeah. Obviously, he had a body type that may be unique in NBA history, and I'm just wondering what that was like when he arrived, and how, and was he the talker then that everybody knows him now to be?
He was different. He was 305 pounds when he came into training camp, and he set a screen and you just sort of absorb into him. It wasn't like you were going to get hurt or anything. It was just like a big soft pillow you run into. But after every practice, Julius and I would sit out, but we would practice at Franklin and Marshall in Lancaster, PA for our training camp. And they had these back brick steps. And we would go out there and just talk about practice and one of our comments after we saw Charles was, this guy's a great, great athlete, but we didn't think his back and knees could take playing at that level, but he did. I mean, he dropped a lot of weight and, he wasn't quite the talker. He wanted to be, but with Moses and Julius, and there were a lot of veterans around that sort of kept him in check. And, we loved Charles because he was such a competitor. He did not like to lose and he wanted to compete and whatever it took, whether it's pass the ball to somebody else, give it up, he would do that. And, I remember one time in practice, we had a drill and he dunked on a guy and knocked him down. And as he dunked on him, he caught his own dunk and threw the ball at the guy laying down. And we stopped practice and said, "Hey, look, you don't do that to your teammate. You can do that to somebody else, but you don't do that to your teammate."
I think people think about that team or those couple of teams where Moses and Dr. J and Barkley and you and like, how did that team not win? Were you all thinking that at the time, or what else was happening there?
Well, there's a lot of things that go on. I know that at the time, a couple of our players were becoming free agents and wanted more shots, wanted more of the accolades, and I think that really did affect how we were successful or how we weren't successful. We won the NBA championship in 83. We got eliminated in the first round the next year. And that was the first time in my 12 years that we ever lost a first round series. And again, probably had our best team. I do think that the players, many of our players were, their perspective was not on the prize, it was on themselves.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about your post-NBA life. I know athletes have this sort of weird career arc where, how old were you when you retired?
34.
So most of us don't retire from the thing that's our main job in life when we're 34. What did you do right after retirement? And did you have a hard time figuring out what you wanted to do?
Well, I took a year off and didn't do anything. I moved back to Charlotte and got my kids in school and just settled in to take care of my family. And then I was approached by the headmaster of the school, Charlotte Christian School, to come and see if I wanted to be involved in the school, and I did. I prayed about it, and that's where the Lord led me. It's funny, most people don't know this, but 2 years after I retired, Billy Cunningham came to me, and he had become a part owner of the Miami Heat.
Okay.
And he told me, "Hey, listen, there's a you know, there's a maximum salary cap.
Right.
There's also a minimum salary cap. He said, we're $900,000 short, and we want you to come and play for us for a year just to help the younger guys.
Uh-huh.
And so I went down, took a physical, and looked around, and I prayed about it and didn't do it. But, you know, I thought about it, you know.
So this was like a year or two after you retired?
Maybe or so.
Right, that's when the heat was started,
yeah,
right?
That's right. And the Hornets and all those things.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Yeah. And but I really had felt a commitment to the school. And, you know, some kids had transferred over to play for me, which I appreciated. And so, yeah, I didn't. And I'd have to say that I look back on my life, and I'm very thankful for the path that the Lord has allowed me to have. And I had an unusual thing happen, Tommy, this past February, I think it was. The Sixers flew me up to Philly and unveiled a statue of me.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
And it was...
So is that there? Was it like the Sixers Hall of Fame or something?
It's the retired number. The jerseys that have retired.
Okay.
They've made a statue. They have a walk in the practice facility. It's a walkway into to the facility. They have these statues outside. And there's, you know, they haven't done all, there's 10 retired jerseys. I think there's 6 statues right now. And so if you see all the statues, everybody's standing straight up. But if you look at my statue from a distance, you think, well, it's broken because it's like this. And I'm diving for a loose ball. And it's a very unusual statue, but it really does epitomize, I think, my life. And I, again, as a Christian, I go back to there's a verse of scripture in Romans 12:2. It says, "Don't be conformed any longer to the pattern of this world." And I think as a basketball player, I wasn't the pattern of the normal basketball player. I wasn't a scorer. I did what they call the dirty work or the hustle or whatever it might be. And I think in life, my goal wasn't to go back to the NBA, be a coach, or to be in that in arena. You know, my path took me somewhere else. And I've really enjoyed that. I've really appreciated that.
I think it's true that people remember you as a hustler on defense and, you know, a shot blocker. And that there's a YouTube clip of two. I know there's one that I remember seeing of you blocking a couple of Dr. J's shots when you were on opposing teams. But I will say this. What I remember is that you were a frequent and enthusiastic dunker. and I guess what I want to ask is, for the earthbound among us, how much fun is that?
It's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. You're up there a long time. The danger is if you're like I've coached kids and I've seen young guys who are short and can jump really well. You're so high off the ground at that point, there is a danger of injury. For me, you know, I was rarely dunk in a crowd. I would usually dunk on a breakaway or something. But it is fun. It's a great feeling.
Well, that seems like a good place to stop thinking about you dunking and coming down. Bobby, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Tommy.
All right, I appreciate it. Bobby Jones spent some time in our interview talking about how pro basketball to him was more a job than a dream. It's something most of us don't realize from the outside. How much work goes into the kind of career that looks like so much fun from a distance. But after the interview, as we were walking out the door, I happened to mention another North Carolina basketball legend, David Thompson, who played at NC State and could jump so high, his nickname was the Skywalker. Thompson and Bobby Jones were teammates in the pros with the Denver Nuggets. And Jones told a story about how he was in a game one night going for a rebound when he felt 2 knees against his back, almost up to his shoulders. It was David Thompson, skywalking, grabbing the ball out of the air. Almost 40 years later, Bobby Jones's eyes lit up when he told that story. The life he led could be a grind, in the same way that watching sports, if you watch a lot of it, can sometimes be tedious. But every so often, if you watch, and especially if you play, you get to see a miracle. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canale. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or nominations for the NBA's Greatest Dunker, well, Don't even bother with that one because the right answer is Dominique Wilkins. Still, for other stuff, you're welcome to email me at ttomlinson, first initial, last name, at wfae.org. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on wfae.org, where each episode has show notes on that week's guest. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.